right. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I am your host, Graham Culbertson, and my guest today is Ray Dorsey, co-author of the book The Parkinson's Plan. So, Ray, can you start by just telling us a little bit about who you are and how you came to co-author this book?
Graham, thank you very much for having me on your podcast. So I'm a neurologist, and I specialize in the care of people with Parkinson's disease. In 2018, I had the gift of a sabbatical when I was at the University of Rochester, and I was wondering why Parkinson's disease, which was first described by Dr. James Parkinson in 1817, he described six individuals with the disease who he casually observed walking on the streets of London. 200 years later, it's estimated that 6 million people worldwide had the disease. And I was curious, how'd you go from a disease that was not classified in the medical literature affecting six people to one affecting 6 million in just two centuries? So I ended up spending a lot of that sabbatical reading the work of my colleague, Dr. Caroline Tanner, who's now at the University of California, San Francisco, who's a fellow Parkinson's specialist, but also has a PhD in epidemiology. And she quietly, diligently, for 40 years, has been telling us that the principal causes of Parkinson's disease are not in our genes, not in our DNA, but are outside of us in our environment. And I came away convinced that she was right and that chemicals in our food, water, and air are fueling the rise of this largely man-made disease, and thus this disease is largely preventable.
Okay, wonderful. So I'll say now a couple things. One, this book caught my eye because my mother was diagnosed with Parkinson's 7 years ago. I certainly, I don't think I would have invited you on if not for my personal connection. But what really struck me was precisely what you just said. This is a preventable disease. It's a man-made disease, and really to go more to the point, it is the creation of industrial technology, if I have that right. In other words, the reason why we see this popping up in the 19th century is because this is when we have, over the previous century, started doing wide-scale uses of chemicals. Is that roughly right?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm sorry to hear about your mother. Parkinson's disease, as Michael J. Fox says, sucks. And it doesn't just suck for the person with the disease. It sucks for their families, for their children, and for their friends. And that's what motivates me every day to work to try to prevent it. You mentioned that your listeners are a little more on the academic side, so I'll give you a little more of an academic story. So in 1971, an epidemiologist named Abdul Omran was really curious what led to the growth of human populations. So Homo sapiens have been around for about 200,000 years. For most of the time, we've been not major bit mammals on the planet. And he looked at three different periods of human populations. He said the first period, humans largely died from pestilence and famine. There just wasn't enough food to go around, and that limited population growth. Second period, beginning about 10,000 years ago with the Agrarian Revolution, was a period of receding pandemics. The Agrarian Revolution led for excess food production, storage, formation of cities, people could come in closer contact. So you see smallpox, infectious diseases like smallpox, influenza, bubonic plague, being the chief source of death and disability. And then he said, we now live in an era of degenerative and man-made diseases. And what does he mean by man-made diseases? So some of them are pretty clear. Car accidents, one of the leading causes of death for young adults in the United States, is clearly a man-made disease. But for cars, no one would be dying in car accidents. But others are maybe a little bit less clear. So it turns out that lung cancer, which is the leading cause of cancer death in the United States, and around the world, largely in early 1900, United States largely did not exist. It was so rare that it was considered a once-in-a-lifetime oddity. All the doctors and students would gather around thinking they would never see another case. Unfortunately, they were wrong, because in the early 1900s, cigarettes were introduced, and 25 years after cigarettes were introduced, which allowed smoking at scale, you saw a corresponding rise in lung cancer. Peak smoking among Americans peaks at 1970, and 25 years after that, you see a decline in lung cancer rates. And I think, as you're alluding to, Parkinson's disease is just another example of a largely man-made disease. Dr. Parkinson describing it in 19th century London, at the height of the Industrial Revolution and the capital of the Industrial Revolution, the air over London, air quality over London was so bad you couldn't see across the street. It was equivalent to what's in Delhi, India today, and what New Yorkers experienced in, I think, 2022 when the skies over the Big Apple turned orange.
Yeah, yeah. That, again, this, I mean, that story makes a lot of sense. There is a, I guess I'll briefly mention for you more than for my listeners, because my listeners have heard this many times, there is a strand of the anarchist tradition which is very interested in that pre 10,000 years ago world, that sort of the famous argument is the original affluent society that we've misunderstood. And actually, they had enough food back then. Mostly, it wasn't ideal, but it was pretty good. I'm not out there advancing this argument, but I am struck by the way that all of the, let's say, I've spoken in addition to you now to climate scientists and a food scientist, and it does seem that we're in this world now in which the classic human problem, can we feed everyone, has been solved, and hopefully the classic human problem of disease remains pretty under control, depending on how vaccine uptake continues in this somewhat difficult era around vaccines. And then now we have a problem of overabundance, of overproduction. I would have never put Parkinson's on that list. Ricardo Salvador, his focus is on the nutritional problems. The climate scientists are interested in the way that agriculture uses far too much petroleum products and contributes to climate science. Parkinson's, it seems, though, is in that boat as well. Our food, our golf courses, our cars are poisoning us, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, and so other people know way more about food than I do, but I would say that we are not a healthy nation or a healthy society. That Parkinson's is one of the world's fastest growing brain diseases, that 1 in 31 children have autism in the United States, that 1 in 3 85-year-olds in the United States will develop Alzheimer's disease, that the prevalence of ALS and brain cancer is increasing, not decreasing, that cancer rates among young Americans, I think 7 different cancers among Americans under 50 are increasing in their incidence. These are all signs that something is wrong, and I think you hear that from the American public. I think you hear that in the distrust for science, and I think you hear that in the distrust for medicine. And I don't think we have answered that call. I think we've become a little bit too content with what we're offering. We're a society that spends 1 in 5 of its dollars on healthcare or sick care, and we're not getting great value for it. And I think it's incumbent on people like me to identify that Parkinson's is growing faster than can be expected by aging. And then we need to find out what the causes of diseases are so we can prevent them, slow them, and treat them, and get rid of them. Diseases are not permanent fixtures of human society. Diseases come and go. We live in a world largely free of polio. No one's dying of typhus. No one's dying of smallpox. I mean, there are lots and lots of diseases that we have said goodbye to as societies. It's time that we start saying goodbye to Parkinson's.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that framing you just gave me, diseases come and go with different social structures, I'm sure that's obvious to a lot of people, but maybe I hadn't quite heard it put that way. My kids were asking me, because of something we learned about pirates or sailors or something, about what scurvy was, and I was trying to explain, and then they were like, well, how do you get scurvy? And I thought about it, and I was like, You really got to be far away from vegetation for a really, really long time, or have an unbelievably limited diet that is frankly difficult to achieve if you're not on a 17th century sailing ship. And I just realized, like, that's, of course, scurvy is a disease caused by a certain kind of transportation. It's a technologically created disease. Of course, it's also a inherent part of how the human body works and the relationship between the human body and the foods it consumes. But you're not gonna get scurvy outside of these circumstances. And so Parkinson's is another, is like scurvy, a disease created by new circumstances that humans are living in.
Yeah, society. Listen, if we don't have pesticides, if we don't have air pollution, if we don't have dry cleaning chemicals that are known to cause cancer and that we're still using, we get rid of a lot of Parkinson's disease.
Yeah. Well, that's, again, that's the thing that astounded me. So I found about your book through the Nicholas Kristof column about it, and it struck me that in a very... I mean, maybe mild-mannered is not the right term, but in a very scientific and mainstream way, you and your co-author are calling for a truly radical new way of organizing the world. I guess briefly let me say what I mean by radical. So the roots of of the word radical actually are the roots. It means going to the roots and getting something. I'm a big advocate for radical change, by which I don't mean what is a lot of people define radical and revolutionary to be the same thing. Revolutionary means sweeping away everything and sort of starting over, and often doesn't touch the roots. So often revolutions you see roughly the same. You know, there's a guy who commands the army named George in charge of the Americas in the 1770s, and there's a guy, a military guy named George, who commands the Americas in the 1790s as well. You get a revolution, things change, but also a lot of things are the same. Radical means to the roots, and it sounds like we have to change the roots of our production, especially of our food, if we are going to root out these diseases like Parkinson's.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are people who know way more about food. You know, Michael Pollan, you know, his simple thing is eat food, not too much, and mostly plants, you know, in seven words summarizes what a great way for following it. Our book, maybe it's a very simple inspiration, since you mentioned the revolution, is Benjamin Franklin says, an ounce of prevention's worth a pound of cure. That's what we're saying, is that this disease is preventable and we should devote significant, substantial efforts to preventing the disease. If just 1% of Parkinson's disease is preventable, the economic value of that is $500 million per year, half that to Medicare, half that to families, individuals and families affected by the disease. We have a chance to generate enormous economic value in addition to relieving immense suffering. And if we don't take those actions, that's a shortcoming on us.
Yeah. And I mean, look, the food stuff, the food stuff is obvious in terms of the danger that, you know, eat food, mostly plants. Yeah. I like that Michael Pollan book. It's Mark Bittman, who I've had on the podcast a few times to talk about food. He's my in-house expert, I guess. But the way we're produced, what surprised me, I guess, is that now you're adding this voice, let's say a medical or an epidemiological voice, to a nutritional and a climate concerned voice, that the way we are growing our food is poisoning us. Bittman says, you know, his line about junk food is that junk food is poison. Like, if you look up the dictionary definition of poison, and it's like something that if you consume it will make you sick, and if you consume enough of it you will die. And he says, you know, well, Twinkies make you sick, and if you consume them enough you will die. So Twinkies are poison, under that definition, which is a little, you know, a little silly, but also I take his point, and I like it. And it turns out that golf courses and dry cleaners, in addition to just what is called conventionally farm or farming with pesticides, is also poisoning us in this really insidious way that we're unable to see.
Yes, yeah, so let's talk about both of those. So Dr. Tanner in 2011 looked at the risk of Parkinson's disease among farmers who used a weed killer called Paraquat. And she found that farmers who use this weed killer widely sprayed on corn, soybeans, fields of corn, soybeans, cotton, and vineyards had 150% increased risk of Parkinson's disease. when laboratory animals are exposed to it, as Dr. Debbie Corey Schlecht at the University of Rochester showed, they develop the features of Parkinson's disease, including the pathological features when you look at their brains. In 2023, my colleagues, Drs. Beata Ritz and Kimberly Paul at UCLA, showed that simply living near where paraquat is sprayed is associated with about a doubling of the risk of the disease. Over 50 countries have banned paraquat. The EPA's own website says that one sip can kill. Even though China and the UK have banned it, the United States still permits it. And according to the latest data available from the US Geological Survey, it's sprayed in increasing amounts on just about every state in the union. So there's an example of something we can take action right now. People can email the EPA Administrator, Lee Zeldin, zeldin.lee@epa.gov, and go, dear Administrator Zeldin, thank you very much for your service. Can you please ban paraquat so we can prevent people from suffering from Parkinson's disease? Unfortunately, paraquat is not the only pesticide linked to Parkinson's disease. Another one is called chlorpyrifos. One estimate is that sprayed on over half of apple trees in the United States. In the lab, it damages the dopamine-producing nerve cells that are lost in Parkinson's. In 2021, the EPA banned chlorpyrifos because it's estimated to have cost 26 million American children, 17 million IQ points. Unfortunately, the manufacturer of the pesticide sued, and a court overturned that ban. So it's now again allowed to be sprayed on apple orchards and I think on golf courses, depending on the state. My colleague, Dr. Brittany Krasnowski, and her colleague, Dr. Rodolfo Savica, at the Mayo Clinic looked at new diagnoses of Parkinson's disease in Rochester, Minnesota, where the Mayo Clinic is located. And they found that individuals who live within a mile of a golf course in Rochester, Minnesota, had 126% increased risk of Parkinson's disease. I think we as a society are paying a really, 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 really high value, really, really high price to use weed killers that other countries don't use, and to use pesticides to make our golf courses very green.
Yeah, I am going to break in now and apologize to say that I skipped two standard steps in the interview, and they should have come at the beginning. Hopefully people made it this far. So first, I realized I am very familiar with Parkinson's, but a lot of people out there will have a vague sense that Parkinson's is a degenerative disease that's bad, that old people get, and also Michael J. Fox. And that's not exactly right. I mean, it's right that Michael J. Fox has Parkinson's. And I realize I should have begun by asking you to explain what Parkinson's is. And now we know that it seems that these chemicals are highly related to the process that involves proteins and folding, but none of the listeners out there know anything about proteins and folding because I neglected to ask you. So can you briefly explain what Parkinson's is, what it does, and how we get it?
So the first major description was by Dr. James Parkinson in 1817, and he described people with a condition that he said not been classified in the medical literature. And what he saw was a tremor, usually at rest, usually asymmetric, usually in the hands, a slowness of movement, and a stoop posture and a tendency to walk forward. In 1850s or 1860s, a French neurologist named Charcot named the disease after him and added stiffness as a core feature of the disease. So classically, it's a tremor, usually at rest, usually in the hands, slowness of movement, nearly universal, stiffness and difficulties with walking or balance. If you have two of those four features, you have Parkinsonism, and the most common cause of Parkinsonism is Parkinson's disease. There are some other causes like medications, antipsychotics, and there are other Parkinsonian disorders that are generally have a less favorable course, like progressive supranuclear palsy or dementia with Lewy bodies. That's what Parkinson's is at a high level. In 2003, a German pathologist named Dr. Heiko Brock said that Parkinson's disease, which we had thought of as a brain disease, has its origins not in the brain, but outside the brain. He said that Parkinson's disease wasn't primarily a brain disease. He says, when I look at the pathology of Parkinson's disease, I find it first in the smell center, the olfactory bulb of the brain, or I find it in the nerve that in the nerve cells that go to the gut, called the vagus nerve. He thought that Parkinson's disease might be due to pathology beginning in the gut that would spread up through the brain like a fall of a row of dominoes, leading to the spread of the pathology of Parkinson's disease. As the pathology spreads, so do the symptoms, beginning, for example, with constipation, then troubles with sleep, then troubles with movement, and then troubles with thinking. In 2019, my colleague, Dr. Per Borkhammer in Denmark, said there's two forms of Parkinson's disease. There's this gut or body first form of disease that starts in the gut and ascends up into the brain via the vagus nerve. And there's a second form that begins in the brain or the nose that begins in the smell center and then spreads backwards, usually primarily on one side of the brain, hence the asymmetry of the disease, and has perhaps early loss of smell and early motor features of the disease like tremor. These both models, I emailed Dr. Borkhammer after reading his work and said that this was amazingly insightful. And I said, how does this fit with chemicals, toxicants that we ingest leading to a gut or body first form of the disease, and chemicals that we inhale, like pesticides from farmers, for example, that we inhale beginning with a nose or brain first form of the disease? He was initially skeptical, but we ended up writing a paper called The Brain, the Body, the Environment, and Parkinson's Disease, which proposes a model, not proof, proposes a model for thinking about how chemicals that we either inhale or ingest lead to two different forms of Parkinson's disease.
Okay, let's... I'm going, you know, certainly outside of my area of expertise here, but I'm struck when reading your book and it's talking about these misfolded proteins, the high level analogy I would like to use, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, is cancer, which is to say the process by which cells become cancerous is totally different than the process by which these misfolded proteins occur. And, you know, cancer, we're talking about a different thing, although maybe related in some ways, since DNA is about encoding proteins. But essentially what it is that your body has a system that is making itself, and that system has gone haywire and it's making the wrong thing. Is that analogy good at all? I understand.
I don't think it's exactly right. I'm not an oncologist, so I won't speak about cancer, but I'll speak about Parkinson's disease. So many neurodegenerative diseases that lead to loss of nerve cells, like Alzheimer's disease, like Parkinson's, like ALS, are due to protein misfolding. So what triggers that protein misfolding? It may be that these chemicals, like metals and air pollution, like certain pesticides, lead to misfolding of a protein. In Parkinson's disease, the protein that's misfolded is called alpha-synuclein. In Alzheimer's, the protein that's misfolded is called beta-amyloid. So that misfolded protein, we've found over the last 15 to 20 years that a misfolded protein that might start in the gut, for example, in response to exposure to pesticides, can spread. And it can spread from nerve cell to nerve cell. So it can spread up the vagus nerve, which is a nerve that's, you know, and me, I'm a tall guy, can be almost a meter in length, 3 feet. It goes all the way from the bottom of my brain all the way into my gut, into other organs as well, spreads up that nerve cell, and then can spread from that nerve cell to other nerve cells in the brain, including above the vagus nerve are nerves that are responsible for regulating sleep, which we know is disturbed in early in Parkinson's disease. And then those nerve cells then connect to the part of the brain that we know is affected in the substantia nigra that gives you the tremor and the slowness of movement. And then it can spread up to higher parts of the brain that are involved in thinking. As this misfolded protein spreads from nerve cell to nerve cell, it leads to destruction. And at that destruction of different parts of the brain produces different symptoms. In Alzheimer's disease, is a different misfolded protein, beta amyloid, that doesn't go back to the substantia nigra, but goes back to the parts of the brain that are responsible for memory and thinking. And as that protein misfolds and spreads, you get different symptoms associated with Alzheimer's disease. So I think the new part that we've identified over the last 20 years, the Nobel Prize was actually awarded for work around prions, which is a misfolded infectious protein. So we don't think these proteins are infectious in terms of spreading from individual to an individual, but they are transmissible. They can be spread from one nerve cell to another. And as they spread from one nerve cell to another, you see the pathology of the disease spread throughout the nervous system. As the disease spreads throughout the nervous system, more and more symptoms become apparent in people affected by the disease.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, the idea that it is infectious in its way, which is to say it's infectious within the body. It spreads around the body. I guess the final thing I want to ask is something I learned very early on when my mom got her diagnosis. I think I got this from one of Michael J. Fox's books, is that in some ways Parkinson's, it shares these symptoms that you mentioned, the Parkinsonism, but in some, and it all seems to relate to these misfolded proteins, but in some crucial ways, literally everyone's Parkinson's is different. Is that still the understanding?
Yeah, so this we can draw an analogy to cancer. There are multiple different causes for lung cancer. Smoking's by far the most important, but radon, asbestos, air pollution all might play a role in lung cancer. And people can get Parkinson's from a wide range of exposure. So I don't know if your mom grew up on a farm or grew up drinking well water, that could be it. We know that the Marines who served at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina were exposed to a cancer-causing dry cleaning chemical called trifluoroethylene, and they had a 70% increased risk of developing Parkinson's disease 34 years later. In 1817, there was no trifluoroethylene, there was no synthetic pesticides. So what was causing the Parkinson's disease that Dr. Parkinson's was observing? I think it might have been air pollution. I could be wrong, but that air pollution has been increasingly linked to it. So people get the disease for a wide different reason of exposures, and some people might get it starting in the gut, which will produce a different constellation of symptoms, and some people might get it in their nose, which will produce a different constellation of symptoms. Some people still might be being exposed to these chemicals, which might lead to a faster rate of progression of the disease. So one of the things we really highlight in the book is that if you're among the million plus Americans with Parkinson's disease, stop getting exposed to these chemicals. Just like if you're a smoker who gets diagnosed with lung cancer, you're going to be told to stop smoking. If you're a farmer working with pesticides and got Parkinson's disease, we want you to minimize exposure to the harmful pesticides that are linked to Parkinson's. Not all pesticides are linked to the disease. So I think those are factors. We know that exercise can favorably modify the progression of the disease. We know that really good care can make a big difference. So there are lots of factors that can benefit people, lots of factors that can make the disease worse. For some individuals, the disease might begin in the gut, which leads to different features of the disease. Some might begin in the nose, leading to different kinds of features. Some might begin in multiple different areas, although we think that's rare. So I think that leads to the vast variability in the presentation in the course of the disease for people. But I think for people who have the disease or who have friends and family members, this disease, just like almost every chronic disease, is modifiable. You know, if you get diagnosed with high blood pressure, the doctor's going to tell you to reduce salt intake, and maybe reducing salt intake can reduce your blood pressure and obviate the need for taking medication. Or if someone's got type 2 diabetes and is now on insulin, we know people can, through diet and exercise, can change the course of the disease, and some people even come off insulin. There are people with Parkinson's, because they exercise, because they're not getting exposed to toxicants, are in better shape today than they were before they had Parkinson's. There are people with Parkinson's, as we highlight in the book, Dr. Sarah Whittingham, who ran an Ironman triathlon after she was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. So I want people to not think that this is a death sentence. My friend Larry Gifford, the founder of the PD Avengers, says that Parkinson's is a life sentence, not a death sentence. It sucks, and that's what Michael J. Fox says, and Brian Grant, many others. But you can help modify and change the course of the disease by stop getting exposed to these toxicants, by exercising, and by getting really good care.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that comes next from that is, I think it seems that one of the big problems with Parkinson's research, and I would guess also a political problem in terms of convincing people to change things, is that you guys have done excellent research, the classic, they call it, you know, gold standard research, linking certain things to an increased likelihood of having Parkinson's, but just as there are people out there who say, well, global warming is not real because it's snowing where I am, or I smoked 2 packs a day for 50 years and didn't get lung cancer, the inherently stochastic or chaotic nature of something like Parkinson's makes it easy for people to deny these causal chains that you have dedicated your life to finding.
Yeah, so I think there's 2 big points, and you bring up great ones, Graham. One is not anyone exposed to a chemical gets the disease. Only 10% of smokers get lung cancer. It doesn't mean that smoking doesn't cause lung cancer. It just means that most people exposed to a smoking don't get it. If we all got diseases that were exposed to asbestos or lead or benzene, we would all be gone very quickly. And the second thing for Parkinson's disease is that there's a huge lag. Just like lung cancer, you don't smoke a cigarette at age 55 and get lung cancer at age 58. You get lung cancer 58 because you were smoking at age 18, for example. And the same may be true for Parkinson's disease. We know from the Camp Lejeune study, the Marines serving at this base in North Carolina, their average age was 20. Some were teenagers, and they 34 years they were getting diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Who's going to be thinking about at 54, thinking about their exposures when they were an 18-year-old and a Marine base contributing to their disease? And so how do we address this? So it turned out that Sir Bradford Hill was a statistician who linked smoking to lung cancer. And he did this through a study called the British Doctor Study in the 1950s. So how did smoking get linked to lung cancer? This is how he did it. He and his colleague Richard Dahl, a physician in Britain, they mailed postcards to British physicians, I think they were all men, and asked them, do you smoke, not smoke, and if you smoke, how much do you smoke? And they sat around and waited for them to die. And then when they died, they compared the lung cancer deaths among smokers versus non-smokers, and if I had the numbers right, people who smoked had a 30-fold increased risk of developing lung cancer. Ergo, smoking is associated with lung cancer. But Bradford Hill was a statistician. He says, I've proved an association. How can I go from an association to a causation? So I think in the 1960s, he articulated criteria that became known as the Bradford Hill criteria, 9 criteria from which you can go from an association to a causation. I can't name them all, but I'll give you some of them. 1, the exposure happened before the disease. You smoked before you got lung cancer. You didn't get lung cancer and then smoke. 2, there's a dose-response relationship. The more exposure, the more you smoke, the more likely you are to get the disease. Farmers appear to be at higher risk of who you're exposed to paraffin appear to be at higher risk of disease than people who simply live or work near where it's sprayed. 3, is this biologically plausible? Does it make sense that if you're smoking cigarettes that this could lead to lung cancer? Does it make sense that if you're exposed to chemicals that damage the energy-producing parts of cells called the mitochondria, which are enriched in the brain and enriched in the particular parts of the brain that are damaged in Parkinson's disease, does this make sense? Is there models in the basic laboratory that are consistent with what we're finding from epidemiological or human studies? If you exposed laboratory mice, rats, and rabbits to trichloroethylene or pesticides, do they develop Parkinson's disease? The answer is yes. So you go through each of these 9 different criteria. My colleague, Dr. Alistair Noyes, and his peers wrote a paper in which they went through these 9 criteria, and they found that, for example, for paraquat, paraquat satisfied almost all of these 9 different criteria. Ergo, you can go from association to likely causation. I think we also need to highlight another thing, is you don't need proof to make actions. There are very, very, very few things in life in which you can have proof. You invited me as a guest on your show without proof that I would be a good guest. You devoted some of your time to read a book about Parkinson's disease without proof that it was beneficial. You put on your shirt this morning without proof that that would be the most beneficial. You choose careers. You choose where to live. You choose how many children you have. You choose any number of 1,000 things that we do as individuals and societies without proof because you use judgment. And so you use the information that you have at hand to make informed judgments. If 50 countries, including China, have banned a pesticide to protect its public health, it might make sense that the United States might want to consider to do exactly the same thing.
I will go even further than judgment. So my favorite philosopher, William James, he says that most scientific research begins with a belief before even a judgment. And then what the scientific process does is let us, you know, keep the beliefs that turn out to be justified and throw away the beliefs that are not justified. But no one sets out to say, you know what, I'm going to study the relationship between this pesticide and Parkinson's, and I really don't believe there is one. Or perhaps some people do, but that's rare. Much more likely the scientist says, I believe this is there. And so belief is actually the start of the scientific process, and the scientific process is designed to get rid of beliefs that turn out to be false. Belief, then judgment, then evidence, then possibly, sure, if you can, proof. But proof is, as you say, very, very hard to come by in any realm.
Yeah, and Bradford, I think one of his other things was consistency of finding. So you might have a scientist who has a particular belief and is going to work really, really hard to justify or provide evidence for that belief. But when multiple different scientists in multiple different parts of the world come to the exact same conclusion, many of them dispassionately, then I think you need to like sit up and pay attention.
Yeah, and odds are good their dispassionate study will be spurred by the belief of this other scientist. And if the science is working correctly, their dispassionate belief will confirm their dispassionate research will confirm or deny the belief of this other scientist. And then the scientist, if they are a proper scientist, will let go of their belief if it cannot be verified by their colleagues. We're heading towards the end of our time. And now the second thing that I should have done at the beginning is tell us about the book itself. What's in the Parkinson's plan? The book, not the plan itself, which is also, you know.
So the Parkinson's plan is available at any bookstore. It is actually a plan to, one, prevent the disease, two, learn why the disease begins, three, amplify the voices of those affected, and four, navigate the new frontiers of treatment. If you're not like Graham and you don't like to read books, we have the Reader's Digest version of the book, which begins on page 237. It's got the Parkinson's 25, which are 25 actions you can take in your everyday life to reduce your risk of getting Parkinson's disease, or if you already have the disease, to possibly slow it. I'll just read one briefly, if that's all right, Graham.
Yes, go right ahead.
Number one is wash your produce, even your organic ones. Pesticides have contaminated our food supply. Remnants of pesticides are found in 20% of common foods. Organic produce, dairy products, and meat can reduce exposure, but can still have unsafe residues of pesticides. So wash your produce at least with water and consider simple vegetable washes, vinegar, or salt solutions too. So we give you 25. Some more might be obvious like exercise. Some may be a little bit less clear like checking your water, your well, if you have a water well, considering an air purifier, not poisoning yourself, and dry cleaning cautiously. And so we wrote this book for people who are affected by Parkinson's so we can give them some concrete actions to slow the rate of progression. And we really wrote it for everyone that's concerned about not getting Parkinson's disease, because we think Parkinson's is largely a man-made disease and therefore is preventable. And we give you the best evidence that we were able to compile over 2 years to help reduce your risk of ever getting this terrible disease as individuals, as communities, and as societies.
So I guess, I don't know, maybe that's an ambulance going by. I'm guessing you're in a hospital adjacent environment.
I'm in New York City in Midtown at a new organization called Atria, which is focused on preventing diseases. So we don't have as many ambulances.
There's plenty of noises in New York City Midtown. A couple things I want to say about the Reader's Digest version. First, I was thrilled to see Drink Lots of Coffee on there. That's great. That's what I'm doing already.
Caffeinated coffee.
Caffeinated coffee. If it's not caffeinated, it's not coffee. Sorry, people out there. I was also thrilled to see get good sleep on there, and at least at the like NPR, New York Times level, there has been recent coverage of a new study about the relationship between sleep and, this would have been after your book came out, sleep and this proton misfolding happening. So you read these stories of people like Bill Clinton famously decided he wasn't going to sleep very much so he could be a great man and he could be working all the time. I tell my students that sleep is your friend and actually you'll do better work if you're sleeping, but also not sleeping increases your risk of any of these proton misfolding diseases.
Protein misfolding.
Yeah, sorry, I said proton. Protons do not fold as far as we know. Protein misfolding diseases. And then the last thing I'll say, and then I'll turn it over to you for the last word, is I'm deeply impressed by this book with its very, very concrete, everyday practical guidance. You know, drink caffeinated coffee, don't live on golf courses, test your well water, and then the awareness that this is, in the long run, a large-scale political problem, because as you say, we are not a healthy society, and we will continue to identify more things we can do to make things healthier, but there's some very, very clear changes we can make, as I've covered on this podcast before, related to things like nutrition and global warming, but also clear now to neurological disorders. We know what to do in our personal lives, at least if you get the book, and we can work on what to do in the broader systems that we are all a part of. And I just appreciate the, you know, I would call it like the everyday radicalism of this project. You're asking for big, but also sensible and clearly defined changes to make the world a better place. I can't ask for more than that.
Outstanding, Graham. I couldn't say it better, so thank you very much.
All right. It was a real pleasure, Ray. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.